Okay, I'm going to talk about some recent numerical simulations we did on the atmospheres of giant planets. But the background is this famous curve, which almost everyone in the room should know what this is. It's a transit light curve of HD 209458. So you can see the flux decreases by 1.5%. The flux of the star decreases by 1.5%. At the minimum, the transit lasts just a few hours. And from that information and the radial velocity data for this particular object, one can get the almost exact mass of the planet, not modified by Sinai, and the almost exact radius of the planet. And the radius of this planet is actually what generates the problem and is part of the motivation for the calculations we did. Here are the properties of HD 209458b. Let's see, let's move this. Orbital characteristics, the semi-major axis is only 0.045 AU. The period is 3.5 days, so it's extremely well determined. The eccentricity of the orbit is about 0.03, and that is really the crucial number in this whole on this whole page. Turns out that the number of radial velocity observations for HD 209458, you would think there'd be millions of them. There are, but most of them are taken during the transit. During the transit, the radial velocities are modified to some extent because of the asymmetry of the rotational velocity curve of the star, which shows up in the measurement of the radial velocity. So those aren't any good for getting the overall orbit. Those all have to be thrown out. And what you're left with up until last year or so was only about 30 observations over the rest of the orbit. And so the eccentricity wasn't very well determined. And if you look in the literature, you find numbers ranging from 0 to 0.1. There have been a few more observations recently of this orbit, but still not enough to pin down the eccentricity. So I didn't put an error bar on that number. The error is probably 0.02 or maybe 0.015. But it's a very good chance it's not zero. And that's a little bit surprising because planet's only 0.04 even away from the star. It should have been circularized. It should be a perfectly circular orbit. Okay, the star is a solar type, has a mass of 1.1 solar masses. The radius is 1.15 with some error. And that's, of course, a crucial quantity because the derived radius of the planet depends directly on the radius of the star. And this is probably the major source of uncertainty in the radius of the planet. The metallicity of the star is solar. And here are the estimates of the mass and radius of the planet based on the transit data. The Charbonneau paper gives a mass of 0.69 plus or minus 0.05. And this is the measured radius, 1.35 plus or minus 0.06 in Jupiter radii. And the Cody and Sasloff analysis gives the same mass and a similar measurement for the radius, 1.41 plus or minus 0.1 Jupiter radii. If one compares this with models, just simply take a planet of this mass, start it out at a couple of Jupiter radii, which is the post-formation radius, let it contract in the computer for 4 × 10⁹ years, which is the age of the star, and obtain its radius, you get 1.03 Jupiter radii for a model with a core, a 10^20 Earth mass core. And for a model without a core of uniform composition, you get 1.13 Jupiter radii. And clearly, that's our particular result, but I think two or three other groups have done the calculations with more sophisticated model atmospheres than we got. And the result was pretty much the same. Radius too small. And this model includes the fact that the planet is heating. It's being heated by the star through almost its entire lifetime of 4 billion years. That is, it's assumed to have migrated early in its history to this position near the star. And so its surface temperature is 1,200 degrees or so, maybe 1,300 degrees. And that has a little effect on the expansion of the planet, but not nearly enough to account for the observed radius. So that's That's the puzzle that people have been
so Peter,
talking
I
about.
Just a historical question. Because originally, yes. My recollection was that when Adam did his calculations, he thought he could get the right radius.
Yep, he thought so.
And the difficulty was that the atmosphere, when he deposited the heat too low in the planet.
Yeah, the analysis by Guillot and Shulman later on showed that he was allowing the radiation from the star to penetrate too deep into the atmosphere and heating the weight really quite far down inside, and that
well below
optical depth one.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you take into account non-gray effects and where the energy is deposited at various wavelengths, it isn't as deep as what they assumed. So they got too large a radius, and all the calculations that have been done since that time got a much smaller radius. So the problem is, how do you expand the planet? And there are two ways of expanding the planet by this 20-30%. In each case, you need some extra source of energy inside the planet. One possible source of energy is tidal dissipation inside the planet, and that would tend to expand it. And the order of magnitude of energy you need to get up to 1.35 Jupiter radii is about 2 times, actually, this number is a little obsolete. It's a little bit higher than that, maybe more like 10 to the minus 7th elson, but anyway, not a whole lot. Dissipated well inside the planet. And this, that is associated with the circularization of the orbit. So in order to get this source of energy into operation, you have to have a non-circular orbit that's trying to circularize by tidal effects. And if the eccentricity of 0.03 is right, that would deliver it would deliver 10 to the minus 7th solar luminosities. If the tidal dissipation quality factor, the famous Q factor, were about 2 times 10 to the 5th, which isn't an unreasonable number. For Jupiter, it's in the range 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, I believe. So with that kind of a Q value, that you could actually end the observed, if that observed value holds up. Observed value of eccentricity, you could get the required amount of dissipation. The real question is, how do you get that 0.03? Why is the planet on an eccentric orbit at all? The circularization time with that order of magnitude, the Q value, is 10 to the 8th years. The planet should be in circular orbit. So something is helping up the eccentricity, and it's not clear what that is. But if it's really true, this 0.03, that almost accounts for the size. The other possibility, that's more like what I'm going to talk about today, and that's what our calculations are based on, is suppose you have a synchronously rotating planet, so it has one side facing the star all the time, the night side is dark, it'll generate atmospheric flows from day side to night side, and if those flows penetrate deep enough into the atmosphere, and this is a suggestion by Adam Shulman and Christian Guillot, that some of that energy, only 1% of the stellar flux has to be dissipated down deep in the atmosphere, and then you could generate, again, an increase in the radius by 20% or so, and we could explain it. But it still has yet to be shown whether that dissipation mechanism works.
Is the rest of your talk going to talk about the alternative time histories of this planet and how that would affect?
No, I'm not going to talk about that, actually.
So then you can address it as a question.
Well, the time history of the contraction of the planet?
Instead of migrating, early on, it had come more recently, if it came, it's at a very high eccentricity, so that at some point it was actually closer to the star and it's migrated outwards in terms of paracenter proceeding to its current Sanger axis.
Okay, if it started its migration later in its history, it came in later and just arrived at its present orbit, and you took into account the stellar heating as a function of time, that means it would lose more energy in its contraction. The heating by the star tends to reduce the amount of cooling of the planet, and so it tends to leave it at a given age with a bigger radius. So if it started migrating later, it would have been cooler at its surface during part of its evolution, it would have contracted faster and would have gotten to its present position with an even smaller radius. So we were making kind of a fairly optimistic assumption that it was always there. Now, we haven't looked at the question of whether it might have been farther in at some earlier time, in which case, you know, it's got to be in there for quite a long time to make a difference. But it's the whole heating effect.
The idea that this has to be continuously pumped, the eccentricity, is only the assumption that, that this thing has been there for a while, right? And that if it just scattered in, say, 10 to the 8 years ago, then you'd expect it to still be inflated due to the circularization. Is that what you're saying?
That's the possibility that I was curious about the implication.
Okay, if you scattered it in very late, you mean?
Maybe not 10 to 8 years ago. If you scattered in an eccentricity of 0.99, okay.
A billion years. Okay, then you got 10 e-folding times or something like that, and then you might have a little residual eccentricity left. Well, that's still what we looked at, yeah.
But just to make this absolutely clear, am I correct in understanding, though, that the measurement of the eccentricity is still consistent with zero? I mean, that's what you, is that correct?
Exactly what I was going to say. At least 90% chance is not zero.
It's zero. Zero until someone tells me a 3 sigma result.
3 sigma? Wow, you're brave.
Okay, I would say it's still consistent with zero, but the
radius which don't rely on a non-zero eccentricity.
Well, that's what I'm actually going to talk about, the last 3 determinations of eccentricity all came up non-zero, but the error bars were plus or minus 0.02, let's say. So I can't tell you.
But is that based on the transit light curve? Or
No. Just the radial velocity light curve, so tracking off all radial velocity data taken during the transit.
Is it feasible that the eccentricity will be determined
You need necessary precision.
Yeah, to the necessary precision.
You're probably going to need in the order of 2 or 3 times the present number of observations of the radial velocities. And the total present number of observations that I understand, throwing out the transit ones, is about 40. It's a question of someone doing it. It's the question of Jeff Marcy getting out there and observing it. Well, he has been observing it, but he's been observing a lot of other things too. So, it doesn't have that small a radio velocity, but you need high precision.
Yeah, but you don't need 3 meters.
Well, I mean, the problem is we haven't got so many measurements yet.
If you could, you're more likely to get more.
Yeah, I understand that if pinning down eccentricities is not that easy.
If you're talking hundreds,
okay. Well, first of all, this is not all year and so on.
Yeah.
Okay, and anyway, this is just the kind of contraction of the planet as a function, the radius of the planet, Jupiter radii, the function time from contraction models. This is log time. Here's the star, HD 209458, the planet, which the age is about 4 to 7 billion years. Even that isn't too well determined. And the radius is 1.3 to 1.4. Jupiter radii, and for the no-core contraction model, which is the upper line, you get down to about 1.1 as opposed to 1.4, and with the core model, it's even smaller, it's 1.1, at 1.0 Jupiter radii.
What's the main effect of making the core models denser? Is it just that rock is denser than gas? Or?
Yeah, the overall density of the planet is higher, the metal abundance is higher, and that makes a little difference depending on how big the core is. And this planet's 0.7 Jupiters, and the core is 0.2. That makes some difference.
It's cooling off quicker too. You don't change the metallicity of the models overall.
Yes, we do.
Okay, but you get a similar effect even if you just put more metals in the core and kept the overall metallicity fixed.
Well, oh, okay, if I subtracted that amount of metallicity from the envelope and did the calculation again, okay, it's still, the fact is more concentrated.
Exactly, that's the point I was
yeah, it's going to make it.
So you got more gravity.
It's going to make a difference.
Now there is the, you also get more cooling
factors. Yeah, so anyway, even with very optimistic assumptions on the composition and the opacities and all the other variables that you could throw in, you're not going to push this up to above 1.2. Excuse me? It's about...
It's like it's a Pustel radii.
Wait, the Roche radii is a...
No,
the Roche radii is a planet. It's about 10 Jupiter radii.
Yeah,
okay.
It's only a few planets.
Maybe six. Actually, maybe only six Jupiter radii.
10 Jupiter radii is one star.
But the claim is it's even mass.
And it's 10 Jupiter, it's 10 stellar radii away. Yeah.
I saw that too. It's not just Lyman Alpha now, they claim to detect.
There's Lyman Alpha and some, I forget the name, oxygen carbons. And some, but oxygen, yes, but anyway, there is other stuff that's apparently flowing away. The mass, it's hard to get the M dot from that, but I think that's been estimated.
Well, they
did a great estimate of the M dot. Right. Yeah, I mean, it must be way off. I'm sorry?
Well, I think the absorption of
the
estimate
of
mass
is pretty. So it's losing mass, but it's been around for 4 billion years. So clearly it couldn't have lost a huge amount of its mass. Hey.
And even so, at that altitude, you're losing very, very
I mean, the density you're talking about is extremely low. It's way above the photosphere. All right, here's the most important question we're willing to look at here is not so much the radius, but what's the temperature on the dark side, which would have implications both on the cooling history and on, eventually detecting the planet and seeing its light curve, a function of phase as it moves around the planet. So it's important to figure out whether it's uniform temperature all around, like as Jupiter is, or whether there's a big day-to-night difference. And the second question is this expansion question: can atmospheric circulation generate some dissipation down deep in the atmosphere and cause a little expansion? And it has to be pretty deep. Is not at the photosphere. If you dissipate energy near the photosphere, it'll just escape. It won't go into PdV work of expansion. So it's got to be down at 10 bars, 100 bars pressure, which is way below the photosphere, or deeper. And the amount of energy needed is the same number as I quoted for the tidal dissipation. So here is Doug Lin's back of the envelope calculation. of the temperature on that side. And then I'll show you some numerical simulations that we did. But this is all elementary. So first you get the standard photospheric condition on the day side, D sub D means day. The opacity, kappa P equals 2/3 G. G is acceleration of gravity. No one's gonna argue with that, okay? Then you simply use ideal gas for the outer layers, which is also very good. So the density rho at the photosphere is P times the mean molecular weight, which is about 2, and the gas constant and the temperature, T, on the day side. Then you need a density scale height at the photosphere. So basically the layer thickness. And you get that definition as rho over d rho by dz. Z is the radial coordinate measured inwards. And that you get from hydrostatic equilibrium of dp dz equals g rho. And you end up with cd squared over g. Cd is the sound speed on the day side. That's the scale height. Then you calculate the thermal energy per unit area on the day side near the photosphere, and that's just the density times the h. That's the surface density, grams per square centimeter in the layer, times the thermal energy per unit mass, which is Cd squared. So that's the energy per unit area, thermal energy per unit area, and rho Cd squared is the pressure. It's practically isothermal in the layer. You don't have to worry about temperature differences. The rho Cd squared is the pressure, so it's Pd times Hd. And so you take the Pd expression from the line one, and the Hd expression from line three, and plug those in, and get it, this energy is 2 Cd squared, sound speed squared, over 3 times kappa d. And the idea is, one of the ideas is to figure out what the result is as a function of kappa d, the opacity, in the photosphere. All right, now we want cooling time. We're going to just compare two timescales. One of those is the cooling time on the night side. So when the hot material with this amount of energy circulates around to the night side, it's going to cool, but simply by radiation. It's no longer heated. The star and the time scale will simply be EH, the energy content of the hot material divided by the flux on the night side. So that's sigma TN, the night side temperature to the fourth. So that's the cooling time. Next step is to simply equate the time scale of advection of the material from the hot side to the cold side to the cooling time on the night side. And that should be self-regulating. In other words, you should approach an equilibrium if you do the calculation for times long compared to either of these advection time or cooling time. So the cooling time was the expression I wrote down before, EH over sigma T n to the fourth. And the advection time is simply the radius divided by velocity, radius of the planet divided by velocity. VF is the flow of velocity from the day side to the night side, driven by the pressure gradient. Assuming you start off with a hot side and a cold side. Okay, so solve that equation. Very simple, you get the night side temperature. And so you get this collection of quantities. This is the flow velocity, the sound speed on the day side, the opacity on the day side, except for Boltzmann constant, and the radius of the planet, which you know. All of which you know. The only thing you don't know is VF, the flow velocity. But suppose you say that's going to be something like the sound speed on the day side. And it turns out from the numerical calculation that's not way off at all. It is close to sound speed. Put in kappa of 1, say, just to put in a number, and Vf equals Cd. And the day side temperature for this particular planet, as you get from equilibrium temperature and the radiation of the star, and when we say 1200 degrees, it gives you Cd. It's around 3 times 10 to the fifth centimeters per second. And night side temperature is 400. That's with kappa of 1. That's a high opacity. That's the opacity you would expect if you had almost interstellar grain abundance with some condensed matter at this temperature of 1,200 degrees. Suppose you reduce it by a factor of 100 to the value appropriate if you just had molecular sources of opacity in the atmosphere. It's probably more reasonable. We don't know for sure. That's why we started off with 1. So a factor of 100 in temperature can give you 100 to the 1/4 power, and so you get 1,200 degrees from that side temperature. So almost the same as the base side temperature. This says, depending on the opacity, maybe it's cooler, maybe it's not much cooler. Okay. Then we did some numerical simulations. These are approximate, but they're two-dimensional, 2D hydro. Just the atmosphere layer. And the two dimensions are the depth in the atmosphere. So we went down, say, 5% of the way to the center, outer 5% of the radius. And we have a horizontal coordinate, which is, say, the azimuth around the surface of the planet. So you've got one surface coordinate and one depth coordinate. Simplifying it, doing a 2D. Straight hydrodynamics on a grid. Including radiation diffusion equation, which we solves using this flux limited approximation, which takes into account the flux limit in the limit of very small optical depth. So we can do the layers above the photosphere at least somewhat physically reasonably, though not exactly. Then we heat the plant on the day side, the 1200 equilibrium temperature, about 1200 degrees. On the night side, it's set, this boundary temperature for the radiation transfer is set to 100 degrees, sort of a nominal temperature, which you might expect just from the plant's own heat escaping, generated down inside the plant, escaping on the night side. That planetary heat generated internally is very, very, very much smaller than the irradiation from the star. It's like four or five orders of magnitude. Okay.
That's why you end up with flow velocities that are part of the sound speed, because of that huge difference in temperatures.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you put in a lower opacity, then is that approximation still reasonable?
For the sound speed? It turns out it's about half the sound speed. it's less because you get the slower flow. Obviously, you get a slower flow. But that 1200 estimate that I've put down for the temperature should be dropped a little bit, but not very much because it only goes to the 1/4 power. So, the opacity is a parameter. High opacity with grains interstellar abundance, that's clearly on the high side as far as opacities go for a planet. We changed the opacity by 5 orders of magnitude, from a factor of 100 above this to a factor of 1,000 below that. And we see what the effect of the opacity is. And okay, the 2D grid extends from the substellar point all the way around to the antistellar point on the night side. And it's actually not a terribly fine grid. Maybe it probably should be done again with an improved spatial resolution, but I'm suspect that that's not going to change things. The initial condition was the contraction model that I showed you a couple of pictures ago. Contraction from 2 Jupiter radii in 4 billion years down to a radius of about somewhere between 1.1 and 1.2 Jupiter radii, a little smaller than the actual planet, actually, because there was no heat, there's no extra heating source in the contraction model. So we just took that model, the spherical model, heated it to 1,200 degrees all the way around as the input, and then we cooled the dark side, and the flow started. The calculation was run for about a year. It could even be real time. No, it was shorter than a year real time, but the actual computational time was about 10^7 seconds. The radiation cooling time in the surface layers, which is important, is about a few 10^5, so we ran few hundred cooling times. And the flow crossing time is about 10^5 seconds also, so it's a few hundred flow crossing times. So it actually did come to a steady state flow.
Is there an argument why the dependence of, heating on latitude is not important?
The answer is no, it is important. But this is a simplified calculation. It is the first, there have been several calculations done on this. The groups doing James did one, and Shulman Guillot did one, but they're all different assumptions. It's hard to compare, but they were 3D or pseudo 3D, this is just 2D, but it has radiation transferred with diffusion in it, which the others didn't. That's one of the main differences. Here's an example of results. So what you're looking at is cross-section of this is the computational grid. The horizontal direction is the azimuth, the horizontal position on the planet surface or near the planet surface. And the vertical is the depth. So y is the depth, and this is in 10^9 centimeters, and this is in 10^9 centimeters. The two scales are different. It's really very, very stretched out, elongated grid. The black region is just very low optical depth, and the black line is the photosphere. That's an important thing to look at. And the day side's on the left, and the night side's on the right. And what you're seeing is temperature, the colors, I mean. And the velocity arrows, you probably can't see very well.
And is there dissipation in the shear layer?
Haven't gotten to that yet. I think there is, but I'll come back to that in a minute.
Tell me whether this works or not.
One cannot see the arrows.
Okay, and the arrows above the photosphere, the arrows are flowing to the right, and the velocity is about 3 × 10⁵. So the temperature here is about 1100. The temperature over here is about 500, 600. And the velocity arrows turn around at about this level. So below this point, they're going the other way. So there is a reflecting boundary condition for the velocity at both ends. Although we've also done it going around the full 360 degrees instead of 180. That doesn't really make any difference. You might as well do only half of it. Because we're not including rotation. The Coriolis effects are probably somewhat important, but not terribly important, because it's slowly rotating, much slower than Jupiter. I mean, it's a four-day period for the synchronous rotation. So there's a return flow generated, and so you have a closed circulation loop going from higher temperature to lower temperature, and there's a shear layer right in between. And according to our estimates, there it should be some energy dissipated in that shear layer.
So your point there confused me a bit, because what is actually rotating at 4 days, and is that included? Is something in the bottom of your simulation rotating at 4 days, or is that omitted?
There's no Coriolis force terms in the equations. Although we actually have experimented with them, we're assuming it's not rotating but synchronously rotating with orbital motion. So the same side's always facing the star. There's no rotation in the model.
There's no shear at the bottom.
Well, then we can get shear in the vertical velocity component.
But sure, the sure. Top, the star is not rotating. There's no rotation.
There's no rotation in the calculation.
It's fixed.
There's no rotation.
They have a ball they're shining.
Okay. Still.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of an equatorial annual. Right. Anyway.
So, Omer, what was your question?
No, you include diffusion and everything, but you say you estimate the dissipation. So there's no dissipation in the numerical simulation itself, which is then contributing to the steady state you realize.
What we did is generate the flow pattern without viscosity, without dissipation,
yeah.
And then make an estimate of post facto,
okay,
of what the shear layer would do, and that's in that sense is not consistent, but that can probably can be done later, right? Yeah, we can do that later. So
if it's going to be turbulent, you should see the simulation. So you're saying that the shear layer is stable in your simulation?
Shear layer stable it is stable. There's no viscosity in the calculation.
Well, but I mean, you can get this thing being unstable because there's no viscosity. Yeah. But you don't see that. Yeah.
We don't see an instability. But if you calculate the Richardson number,
I was just going to say. Richardson
if you calculate the Richardson number, it's unstable.
Why don't you see your simulation?
Well, what's the grid? Because it's too viscous.
Because
it's
the grid.
Grid is too viscous.
Yes, not
too
much numerical. You haven't resolved.
It's not that. I guess it's numerical. It's probably numerical viscosity.
Yeah.
But that numerical viscosity isn't included in an energy equation, and it isn't generating heat.
That's right. It's not included in energy. It's not included in energy equation.
Right.
Yeah. So
you
really that
there's no energy. You don't see any viscosity. I mean, you don't see any turbulence because the viscosity is too high.
We don't.
But you don't take into account the heat that would generate.
You do not take into account the heat. That is correct. That is correct.
If you do estimate it, it's bigger than 10⁻⁷.
But if you do estimate it by just taking an assumed viscosity, we don't know the viscosity. Assuming there's some say an alpha viscosity. And just multiplying that by the square of the velocity gradient, get the energy dissipation rate. depending on what you take for your viscosity parameter, it can be significant compared to the incoming stellar radiation. The problem is it's shear layer. It's just below the photosphere.
Too shallow.
It's very shallow.
Yeah, okay.
In order to get dissipation that would really, pump up the radius, you've got to be way down there.
So the answer is it doesn't work. This model doesn't work. This
model does not work.
Okay.
The model
works fine.
The calculation, the results are fine, but it does not pump up the planet's size.
What's the flow velocity at equilibrium?
It depends on where you are, but the sound speed, more or less sound speed in this particular case, which is 3 × 10⁵. In the upper layers, and then the return flow is a little slower, and then there are velocities far down, but they're so small you can't see it.
What's the difference in the temperatures?
1200 photosphere on the day side, and it's about 500 photosphere on the night side. It's a big difference, and
that's depending on the optical depth.
At the photosphere, which is this line right here. So it's. And it's a good agreement with that back of the envelope calculation.
Return flow, that's moving with respect to the layer below it.
They're shearing all the way down.
That's my question. Is that layer down there? Is there a large enough shear there to give you, a good amount of energy dissipated at a much higher depth?
I actually have a plot of the energy dissipation contours on the grid. And we calculate over the whole grid, okay. But the velocities are much lower down here, and so the shear is much less.
That's only 10% of the whole range in the star.
5%. Right, and we're only going down to about 10 bars, I think. But if there were significant energy dissipation in the lower level, we would have picked it up, and it's much less than what you get up here. Okay. I mean, there's a little bit, yes, but it's simply order of magnitude less than what you get up there. right. Okay. They're not negligible. So if we put them in, I think that we're going to get a similar flow, but there will be some differences. I mean, I don't think there'd be that much of a difference in day to night temperature, though. If you did that, I actually did a couple of experiments with a couple of terms in, but you really have to do it in 3D. You can put in some 2D effect Coriolis effects, but you really have to do it in 3D, and so that'd be the next stage in this type of calculation.
And what's the hang-up, just numerical time, or
the physics is pretty much straightforward. It's a question of doing extremely long computer calculation, because if you add the radiation transfer, the way we're doing it, it soaks up a huge amount of time. If you want to resolve, this thin layer is, it's very much longer than this thick, and so you actually need thousands of grid points around, which we haven't put in yet. So, if you want reasonably square zones, in other words, that means a whole lot of zones in the horizontal. Okay, here's the second case. Just look at case three. This is the low opacity case. A factor of 100 down. And so the photosphere, of course, is going to be much lower, much deeper. Lower opacity, optical depth one is going to be at a higher density. So you get the layer that's moving to the right going down to a higher density, so you can effect more heat over more efficiently. So there's more of an effective flow. And that side cooling time is about the same, but the end result is you increase the temperature on that side, and the day side is still 1100 degrees, and that side here is more like, at the, go down to the photosphere, it's more like 800 or so, instead of 500, or maybe 850. So noticeably hotter, and not that much different from the day side. But the flow is very similar. The return flow is essentially it starts just below the photosphere. It's this region right in here. And you can see there actually is like this cooling material from that side actually penetrates underneath the warmer material from the day side. So you have a temperature inversion right in through here because of the return flow. But okay, but the point is right. point is you can evac energy over more efficiently, and so the cooling time equals the evacuation time at a higher night side temperature. okay, let's see. I'm almost finished here. This just shows the photospheric temperature and velocity for the four cases after equilibrium. So here's the horizontal position on this scale, the temperature going from day on the left to night on the right. So same result, it's the same data as you saw on those color plots. 1200 degrees, you can see a little better, temperatures and velocities. 1200 degrees at day side, decreasing to about 500 degrees on that side for temperature. And there's a little shock at the edge on the far side. That's why it jumps up there at this particular point. And the velocity is for the same case, and close to zero on the day side, increasing to about 3/10 of the F centimeters per second on that side, and then dropping to zero. Okay, that was the high opacity case. The same thing for the low opacity case is the third line. These curves right here. Temperature, again, 1100 or so down to, it's a little above 800, let's say 850 or so, that side. And the velocity, again, you can see it here better, it's much lower. I mean, not much lower, it's still order of 10 to the fifth, but instead of 3/10 to the fifth, it's more like 1 or 2/10 to the fifth. It's lower velocity, clearly because of the decreased gradient pressure. So, atmospheric circulation is induced. No one's going to quarrel with that. Evective transfer increases the temperature on the night side substantially. Results depend on the opacity. I would say that the second case I showed you, the low opacity case, is probably more reasonable in terms of opacity. It simply means that almost all the grains are gone, settled, evaporated down deep inside the planet. And what you're left with is the molecular opacity. You've got the methane and ammonia, the various carbon compounds, the collision-induced hydrogen transitions causing the opacity. And this level is about right. So that would say there's not that big a temperature difference in the case of that opacity. The high opacity is a 500 degree or so difference. The low opacity, well, it's about the same. Well, it's actually a couple of hundred degrees difference, but still it's not very much in the low opacity case. There is a shear layer developed between the day night and the return flow, which is substantial. And depending on your viscosity parameter that you need to get the energy dissipation, this could be a substantial fraction of the input radiation to the star. That is, you could dissipate a substantial fraction of that incoming radiation right there. But if you did, it would simply leave in the form of radiation, then you wouldn't get much or any expansion of the planet. It's got to be deposited farther down. And so, I mean, I presume that if we did these models in more detail and extended the deeper depths, we might find additional shear effects down lower, but that remains to be seen. But it is an unstable layer. So overall, the detailed structure of the outer layers has implications regarding the overall cooling time of the planet. Depending on if part of the planet is cold and part of it's hot, its cooling contraction time, and therefore the radius, will be affected to some extent, but not enough, probably, to explain the radius of the HD 209458. It also has some implications regarding the tidal dissipation and where that occurs. In the planet, for example, in the outer layers, that is outer 5% is mostly radiative because of the heating from the stars, reduces the temperature gradient. And so in this radiative layer, you can generate of various waves. My distinction in the tidal dissipation is not exactly clear where that occurs, whether it's mostly in the surface layers, whether it's deep inside the planet. So the structure of those layers is important for the details of where the tidal dissipation takes place. The interior is all convective.
So actually, that's an incredibly important point. So even if I accept that there's an eccentric orbit there, it could be that the tidal dissipation is all occurring in the surface layers. And again, it won't be deep enough to explain the.
That's important. Yeah. If the tidal dissipation that is occurring is at 10 to the minus 7 tau sun or whatever it is, it's all in those outer layers. Just as in the case of the shear layer, a lot of it will escape and it will not puff up the planet sufficiently. That energy, the tidal dissipation energy also has to be deposited reasonably deep, uniformly. It doesn't have to be uniformly distributed through the whole planet, but it has to be reasonably deep. Again, not right at the poster. The radiative there goes down a ways. The question is, is it far enough down? Okay, and what is needed in the future, of course, is to do this kind of calculation in three space dimensions and include the rotational effects. Okay, thank you.
So, very soon, hopefully, MOST will give you a phase function curve for HD209458. Now, I assume, given your temperature profiles, that you're going to have very different phase functions depending on whether you have these high or low opacities.
You will.
Calculated those things and seen if they'd be useful. Useful to test them against the MOST data. Have you done this for your models?
I haven't. No, that's something we can clearly do, but we haven't done it yet. That's a good step.
Do you see any tidal oscillations
in your calculations? I don't think so. I haven't seen anything like that.
Thermal
And what's the expected period of the oscillation? it could be a longer period than our calculation time, or is it expected to be short compared?
Flow time, that's
but what's the time scale compared to the flow time that we need to know?
I presume most of there's no stratification radio.
There is.
Yeah,
the density distribution, you mean? Yeah, we just take that from a spherical hydrostatic equilibrium planet model. So this is basically in hydrostatic equilibrium.
You have sort of temperature.
So we have like five orders of magnitude in density from top to bottom. It's quite a range. The bottom density is like 10 to the minus 2 or so. Grams per cubic centimeter. Top of the photosphere, more like 10 to the minus 8. So there's a big range of density.
And isothermal?
No, not the temperature is calculated every layer, so the temperature increases also with depth. We include the temperature stratification.
With some set outgoing flux from the contraction.
The bottom temperature, bottom of the grid is set from the energy that's released from the internal contraction of the planet.
That's our
yeah. So that there's a fixed temperature at the bottom of the grid as far as the radiative transfer is concerned. Yeah, so that's taken into account. It's a small amount of flux. but it's still important in a way.
So at the bottom, is it convectively unstable or is it up with that lower?
In our grid extends down to the point where it's not quite yet at the convection zone. It's close. It's not quite there. So it's basically radiated. Actually, we calculated the high opacity case on the night side, the temperature gradient is pretty steep going outwards because it's cool. We calculated the Brunt-Pascal frequency at all points in the grid, and we found a little convection zone there. So in fact, if it's really cold on the north side, you have a strange effect of a convection zone on the north side and a radiative zone on the day side. And that, of course, that would be interesting as far as the tidal effects go. That was the high opacity. That's less realistic than the case with lower opacity, in which case we didn't get that convection zone.